the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church in the world, and we speak about those things that hopefully, if we deal with them correctly, make our world more just and make it more compassionate. And so this week, as we're kind of after Thanksgiving and everybody is kind of a little bit coming down after the busy Thanksgiving weekend and all of those things like Black Friday and like Cyber Monday and Giving Tuesday, all of those things. And now we're kind of, you know, in our church world, we're right slam dunk in the middle of Advent, getting ready for Christmas. And it does correspond a little bit because everybody else is getting ready for the Christmas holidays in terms of purchasing. And I'll tell you a little bit of story about a couple of Jewish friends that I have over the years, and their kids have decided that they're calling it Christmas. And the reason they're calling it Christmas is because they've just done the cost-benefit analysis that you get better presents if you call it Christmas than if you call it Hanukkah. So that's why they want Christmas presents. They're willing to celebrate Hanukkah, but they want Christmas presents. You know, I think that's not a bad analysis of what's going on in their world anyway. So today, you know, we're going to talk about a couple of different topics. I'm delighted that our first guest, who we'll speak with in a few minutes, is a professor from New York University at a Ferrer. And we're going to talk about the life, the complex legacy of Fidel Castro, who died earlier this week. And then we're going to speak about World AIDS Day with Catherine Marshall, who's a senior fellow at Georgetown University. So we're going to talk about a variety of different topics, and I think I just want to get right into our conversation. I'm so glad that Ada Ferrer has come into the office, into the studio with us today, and I'm delighted. So,
well, Ada,
thank
you. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us. Give our listeners just a little sense of your own biography and how'd you kind of wind up now being a kind of fancy professor at a fancy university.
Yeah, well, I was born in Cuba.
Okay.
I won't say the year, but you'll probably be able to figure it out.
Okay.
My parents left when I was 10 months old.
Okay.
So I basically learned to walk and, you know, walk and speak and read and write in New York City.
Okay.
But Cuba was always present.
When you came to New York as a 10-month-old,
yeah.
Where'd your family settle?
Riverside and 135th Street.
Okay, so now kind of let me tell you a little bit of my own history. The first place that I was assigned as a priest was 186th Street and Wadsworth Avenue. Mm-hmm. So I was just a mile or two up the road from where you settled, and in that parish of St. Elizabeth's, there were a number of people who kind of migrated, who fled from Cuba.
From Cuba.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was my parents' story. And they settled in New York, Brooklyn. But as I said, Cuba was always present. They were always obsessed with Cuba.
So they moved from Riverside Drive out to Brooklyn?
Yeah, out to Brooklyn, East New York.
How come?
And all their neighbors, I think it was a lot cheaper for them.
But I mean, the way that this migration bus, you were supposed to swim across the river to Union City.
I did, a little bit later.
Okay.
We did. Okay. We ended up in West New York, New Jersey. And that's basically where I did most of my, you know, elementary school, high school. Right. And it was a community very densely populated. It had about, you know, 40,000 people in less than a square mile. Most of them were Cuban American.
Right.
Went to a really good urban high school with a good honors program.
Right.
And, you know, it made all the difference. But and there in that community, everyone talked about Cuba. So there was, you know, there was Cuban graffiti on the streets. There were Cuban American, actually terrorist groups active and putting graffiti on the walls, calling for the assassination of Fidel and anyone who wanted to talk to him. We had every September 8th, there was the procession for the Virgin of Charity.
Right.
We all went. My mother took me to Mass. The end of the, you know, the part of the Mass where you pray for things, the last one was always a prayer for political prisoners in Cuba. So it was just something that was always there. kind of abstract, but yeah. but there. So the interest was always there. Then at some point, you know, in my early I think actually even before that, in my late teens, I had the sense that I was born in this place, that it had so much meaning in my life, but that I had no memory of it.
Right.
And so I just, you know, I went to college, studied English, then decided I wanted to learn more about Cuba. So I started doing that and really haven't stopped since.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is good. And, you know, interesting. I mean, I was born in the Bronx. As far as I know, I haven't done 23andMe. So, I mean, I don't know what my roots really are. But as far as I know, I don't have any Cuban ancestry at all. But as someone who was in that parish in Washington Heights, and I went there in 1983, and there still were a number of Cubans who were there, not the predominant Hispanic ethnic group, but still a number there. I always was fascinated by Cuba because of the stories that I would hear from the parishioners who were there. So I was always kind of fascinated by it. When was was speaking with Ada Ferrer, who's a professor at New York University, and we're speaking about Cuba. She just told us that she was born in Cuba, came to New York when she was 10 months old, and then she got interested in it and so has been studying it and learning more about it ever since. So when was the first time you went back to Cuba?
1990.
Okay.
So I was then doing a PhD program at the University of Michigan, and I was working on the 19th century, knew I had to use Cuban archives. And, it took a while for me to get there. The fact that I was born there made it a little bit harder than if I hadn't been born there. Right. But I spent a month there in 1990. Then I went back in 91 with my mother, went back in 92 for 3 months to do more significant research. And basically since then, I've been going pretty much once a year. I skipped a few years when my daughters were born, but pretty much once a year.
Now, give our listeners just a little bit of sense, because our listeners probably are not familiar with the relationship with Cuba and that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought nobody could go back.
Yeah, no, initially people could not go back.
Okay.
Then under Jimmy Carter, right. The two governments started allowing family visits.
Okay.
And so if you had relatives in Cuba, you could go, and many people did. And the U.S. made it legal for certain categories of people to go. So if you had a relative, you could go. Yeah. If you were doing academic research, you could go. A journalist could go. There were certain categories that were permissible.
And there was at least a little period of time, I think at the end of the Carter administration, where you could just go to visit. And the reason I say that is because I did it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't a journalist. I didn't have any relatives there. And, you know, and I didn't have to go to Canada, right?
Right,
you
know? Right. Yeah. So I think, I mean, there's also a religious category of exception. So I don't know if it would have been under that. But there were, you know, you couldn't go as a tourist. But if you had a reason for a kind of cultural people-to-people exchange, there were some exceptions.
Okay.
And yeah, and so people, you know, a lot of people think that with the opening that Obama started, that and now with commercial flights starting this week to Havana, that this is something very new, and it is. The commercial flights are new. But even before that, you know, you had 15 flights a day leaving out of Miami for years and years.
And it struck me as just so ironic that that first commercial flight, which made a big publicity about, comes right around the time of Fidel's death. It just strikes me as kind of an irony of ironies, or just eerie.
Yeah, the timing is so uncanny. I saw some pictures, I don't remember if it was in the Times or the Miami Herald that morning, that showed the tourists getting on this first commercial flight directly to Havana. And American Airlines or JetBlue or whichever airline it was giving out straw hats. So it was a picture of all these passengers in straw hats ready to party in Havana. And you think they're going to be arriving in the middle of a funeral. You kind of hope they show a polite, you know, just a modicum of politeness at least.
So you know, I was speaking with Ada Ferrer, who's a professor of Latin American studies at NYU, New York University. I'm going to ask you a very unfair question, but given all of the, you know, the publicity and given all of the strong feelings about Fidel over all these years, Is there, this is an unfair question, but can you summarize, or how would you, what's your take on, you know, what has happened there? And I know it's unfair, but give me your perspective.
I teach a whole course on this.
Right.
And it's a 4 month long.
And I have attention deficit disorder.
Yeah. I mean, I can say a few things. I think for the most part, American citizens understand very little about Cuba, but also about the relationship between Cuba and the U.S. historically. So when Americans think about Fidel or the Cuban Revolution, they really think about it in almost strictly a Cold War frame.
Right.
So Cuban history begins in 1959 when there's a communist revolution, and then there's the Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis, and there's this enmity between these two states, and there's an evil dictator on the other side who's communist, etc. And there is a much longer history, obviously before that, and a longer history of U.S.-Cuban relations, and the U.S. is implicated in a lot of that, in a lot of that history. So one thing that Americans don't know, for example, is that Castro's revolution initially wasn't communist. It was a nationalist revolution.
Really?
And the Communist Party in Cuba actually opposed Castro initially.
Ah.
Right? So that's something that Americans don't ever think about it.
Because
many people don't. They just think of that Cold War frame in which Cuba is a Soviet satellite, it's communist, and that's that. But even the process by which that happened is much more complex and has a lot to do with historic U.S.-Cuban relations, with American property in Cuba, with American actions in Cuba, et cetera, et cetera.
So again, now I'm asking you to speculate, and this is based upon 30 seconds of new information. Yeah. Everybody needs an ally.
Right.
So I assume that there probably was a moment or two when, if American foreign policy had been different, maybe it wouldn't have turned communist?
I mean, I think that's a possibility.
Yeah.
But whether American foreign how different American foreign policy could have been is an open question, right? There were other, you know, there were efforts at democratic, progressive reforms in other states that the U.S. put down, say in Guatemala in 1954, or later in Chile in the 70s. So it's unclear. The hypothetical may not work.
But. So what turned it from a nationalist revolution to then which embraced communist ideology?
Yeah. You can explain it several ways.
Right.
One is that in some sense, putting into effect the promises that Fidel's revolution had made, things like the agrarian reform, cutting rents, things like that, almost necessarily required a confrontation with the U.S. because so much property was American owned.
Okay.
So there's a way in which some of it probably would have happened anyway, right? Then other things that happened were the U.S., you know, a really critical turning point, I think, was the period of the Bay of Pigs and the lead up to that. So the U.S. handled that, as you know, disastrously.
Right.
They assumed that there would be a rebellion in favor of this invasion, and that was based on really faulty intelligence.
Yeah.
So, and then after that, once the invasion happened,
right,
I think there were people, and I know people personally, who had doubts about the new system, but that put those doubts not to rest, but they put them aside and kind of got behind the program. So I think that was a really critical moment. So it was a combination of U.S. economic power in Cuba and then U.S. foreign policy after they came to power.
We're speaking with Professor Ada Ferrer, who is a professor at New York University. We're speaking about Cuba, and we're speaking about it because Fidel Castro died within the past week or so, and we're speaking about that history. I have argued to people, I said I'd be willing to debate the hypothesis that for good or for ill, that in the last half of the 20th century, the most influential head of state in the Americas, in the Western Hemisphere, was Fidel Castro.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, for good or for ill, because, right. I mean, and he basically, for all the rhetoric that could be quite anti-American, he certainly bought Woody Allen's prescription for success, that 90% of life is showing up.
Yeah.
I mean, he showed up for the whole century, the whole last part of the century.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things I'd like, you know, for you to talk a little about it, where you think things might go now. But let me share a little bit of my own very, very limited experience with Cuba. I've been there twice.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there kind of as a tourist in, I think, around 1979 or sometime around then. And just went around, and my reading of life was that if I was going to be a good capitalist, I was going to invest in plaster companies, paint companies, and a new car dealership. Because the whole experience there was that the shelves were pretty empty. There wasn't a lot on the shelf. I saw no kind of military presence or great police presence there. The thing I would say is that, you know, the streets were pretty clean. There was sparse mm-hmm. thing. But the one thing I noted very, very clearly was every single American dollar that I had, I had a check at the door. I mean, mm-hmm. you couldn't take a single dollar in, et cetera, et cetera. So I then go back in 1998 with when Pope John Paul II went. Well, so when I won't go back this time, well, now there's I don't want to say flourishing, but there's a significant tourist industry, which is capitalized by the Germans and the Spanish. I also didn't check I didn't change a single dollar. I used all American dollars in 1998. And there were these micro businesses that were there. I call it kind of, there were beds and breakfasts. You didn't get bed and you didn't get breakfast. You got dinner had to leave.
Right.
But what were they called? Do you remember?
The inns are still called casas particulares, which just means private houses.
Right.
And then there's the restaurants that are called paladares.
That's
and they're
it.
Still called that. Yeah.
Paladares.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that was my little thing. But so you give our listeners a sense of your sense of the changes over the years.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people, you know, think I want to go to Cuba before it changes.
Right.
And as someone who's been, and it will change. It will change more. We don't know exactly how, but it will change more. But as someone who's been going there since 1990, I feel like it's changed so much within those 25 years. So when I went, I couldn't take any dollars. They probably gave you something called A coupons. They had a letter A.
I was
Cuban American,
okay.
So I got B coupons.
Okay.
And when I was there for 3 months and had to feed myself, they gave me, the Communist Party of the province of Havana gave me special permission to buy with my B coupons in the C coupon store, which was for athletes and artists who got paid abroad and then couldn't bring in dollars. So it was a bizarre moment. They legalized the dollar in 1994.
Okay.
So in 1998, you would have been able to use the dollar. Sometime later, they introduced something called CUCs, which is what they use now.
Right.
So it's this currency it's called hard, you know, it's hard currency. It's what they call divisa, but you can't physically use the dollar. There were some private businesses then, but they were very, very limited.
Right.
Owners paid very prohibitive taxes.
Right.
And for example, if you had a paladar, you could only have 12 chairs.
Right.
And you could not employ anyone outside your family.
Okay.
In 2011, which, you know, by then Fidel Castro is no longer in power, Raul Castro is in power, there's a sixth party Congress, and they initiate more economic reforms and allow more people to have businesses. And at that point, you can have a restaurant with many more chairs.
Okay.
You can employ people. And if you were to go to Cuba now, you would be shocked at how many small businesses there are.
Okay.
There's restaurants, there's manicure shops, hair salons, there's even a couple of spas, there's, you know, shoe repair stores, a little kiosk, there's businesses everywhere. Now there's a Yellow Pages.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's nothing compared to the Yellow Pages we're used to, and no one checks phone books anymore here anyway. Yeah. But there's a Yellow Pages with listings for photographers, for almost anything you can imagine.
So, all right. So that change kind of happens, I don't want to say naturally, but it happens kind of over time for a variety of reasons. Again, not to put words in your mouth, but some people have attributed that to the downfall of the Soviet Union and needing for other stuff that they had to develop more economic entrepreneur businesses in that way. So two things seems to me have happened in the same time, and is one, we did have the reopening of the embassy and certain new relations between the United States and Cuba. And within a year of that or so, the death of Fidel. So where do you see...
And the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I didn't mention that because I have a theory that presidents and people like that are less important than everybody thinks, and that not that they're unimportant, but like there's a wave that happens and you figure it out. But anyway, but you're right. Yeah. But the election of Trump is real. So where do you see things going?
Before I tell you that, yeah. I was in Cuba last week, okay. And I heard a Catholic Trump joke.
Okay.
Am I allowed to tell it?
Sure.
So a friend of mine said, did you hear that Pope Francis is really happy with the election of Donald Trump? I said, that can't be. And she said, yes, he set the whole world to pray. That was a joke I heard in Havana.
Right.
It brings together the Pope and Trump.
Right. Okay.
But anyway, where I see things going, I think, you know, these changes had already begun. The main architect of them in recent years was Raul, not Fidel. Okay. There's a sense in which Fidel was very suspicious of those kinds of changes. He thought they could go too far too quickly. Fidel was also much less excited about the opening with the U.S.
Right.
So in some sense, he represented, an older form of revolution that was more purist, more anti-capitalist, more anti-U.S.
And one might argue that that was his brand.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
He almost, that was how he stayed in power. That's how, in a lot of ways.
Exactly. So now Raul's in power, and he has been for about 10 years. And the fact that Fidel is gone, I think, won't make any immediate difference. But it does, the figure who most represented that and represented that very powerfully is now gone. So it does open up space for those reforms to pick up the pace a bit, those economic reforms, not necessarily political reforms.
Well, and just practically, give our listeners a little sense, and you've been generous with your time, so I'm only going to keep you a few more minutes. But I know there were certain things that the president could do, and then there were certain things that were done by statute or Congress that they can't.
You mean in the U.S.?
Yeah, in the U.S., those relationships. What still is in place in terms of the restrictions on doing business with Cuba?
Well, the economic embargo is still in place, and the Helms-Burton Law, which is very punitive with companies that try to do business in Cuba, is still in place. So the things that Obama put in place, he put in place by executive order, and they were things that basically created spaces where people could maneuver within the embargo. So, for example, there are commercial flights, but he hasn't opened up travel. Because to go on the commercial flight, you still have to be in one of the allowable categories.
Okay.
So you can book on American Airlines, but you still have to say, I'm Cuban American or I'm this, right? So,
okay.
So anyway, so he kind of chipped away at the embargo, but the embargo is still in place.
Right. So does that mean that...
And Trump has said that he'll keep it in place. And he's got pro-embargo people on his transition team, so we'll see.
Yeah, but now here's the thing. Does the embargo mean that we can't have a Trump Towers in Havana because you can't invest there?
Right.
The embargo goes.
Yeah. I heard very different opinions in Cuba about what a Trump presidency means. And some people said he's a businessman.
Right.
This is inevitable. He's going to keep it going. And someone said a Republican president with a Republican congressman has a better chance of lifting the embargo than a Democratic president with...
It's Nixon to China.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. Who knows? I mean, who knows, you know, what happens? And as I say, sometimes the march of history, does triumph over ideology, and for good or for ill. I mean, it sometimes happens. But thank you so much for sharing with us.
And I would encourage people to go and see it for themselves.
Okay. They got to just check the right box.
Right box. Yes.
Ada Ferrer is the professor of political science at New York University, and she herself was born in Cuba. She's been traveling back and forth and has some very, very good insights into what's been going on the island. Thanks so much for taking the
time.
Thanks
for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You know, I think we'll take a break, and This is Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love God, your neighbor, and yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. And this is the week after Thanksgiving and the week in which we're in the aftermath of the death of Fidel Castro, arguably one of the most influential leaders, for good or for ill, in the Western Hemisphere in the latter part of the 20th century. And we just spoke with Ada Ferrer, who is a professor at NYU. She herself was born in Cuba and as an infant was brought to the United States in New York. And in a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with Catherine Marshall, who is a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. When we're going to, be speaking with her about the AIDS epidemic, HIV. World AIDS Day is around this time of the year, so we're going to speak with her about what's going on in trying to deal with that epidemic throughout the world. And as we know, it's much less than it had been, but we're going to talk with her about, does it still exist and what's going on and how do we deal with that? Tom, we got any news that you want to share?
We do, Monsieur. I know you and Otto were talking a little bit about Cuba, and interestingly enough, in response to a letter that Pope Francis sent out to the leaders of all the world back in early November at the end of the Year of Mercy, three countries, one of which is Cuba, Pakistan, and Paraguay, have responded to his request that prisoners have some of their sentences commuted and that clemency be given to some prisoners. So the plea was acted upon by Cuba, which, as we have talked about before, is a Marxist country, by Pakistan, which is a majority Muslim country, and by Paraguay. In fact, within 3 hours of receiving the Pope's letter, Paraguay President Cortes responded favorably and promising to release the detainees. And then last Saturday, on November 26th, 16 prisoners were released, and every prisoner that was released with a job in place, which was good. We know that's very important for people getting out of prison. In Pakistan, 60 prisoners were released on the initiative of the government's only Christian minister, who is a senator, Karim Michael, who is also the federal minister of human rights in Pakistan, and 63 prisoners were released there. And then in Cuba, Raul Castro said as of November 15th that he would pardon 787 common prisoners following the Pope's request. So three countries thus far have responded, and it's our hope that maybe some more will respond to the Pope's plea for mercy.
Hey, I think Raul upped everybody. I mean, he did 750?
He did.
That is a...
And you know, Monsignor, kind of interestingly enough, there is a history. As you know, you were with Pope John Paul II when he went to Cuba in 1998.
That's not exaggerated. He was there and I was there. And he was over there and I was back here. So, I mean, okay.
But it was interesting. Now, 100 prisoners were released at that time. Then when Pope Benedict went to go visit Cuba in 2012, 2,900 prisoners were released. And then when Pope Francis went last September, 3,500 prisoners were released. So it seems the number in Cuba goes up and up as time goes on.
As we get more popes going.
More popes going there, exactly.
Popes going there. Okay. All right, that's good. Any other news, Tom?
Sure, yeah. Now, we were always following a little bit about what's going on in the Middle East on the Nineveh Plain. And 2 years after Christians were forced out of the town of Bashkika, which is the suburb of Mosul, they have begun to say Christian masses there. One is called the Church of Mar Korkanis, which is in Bashkika, and it was taken back by the Peshmerga Kurdish forces back on November 7th. And according to Reuters, they have had a first mass in that church for the first time in 2 years since the Islamic State took it over in 2014.
Ah, that's interesting.
They say civilians cannot yet go into the city yet, Monsignor, because it's the Islamic State. This is Bashkika,
okay.
on the border. It's kind of a suburb of Mosul.
Right.
Because the Islamic State, when they retreated, put explosives and mines all over the town. But at least, you know, there is life starting there. Masses has been said there. And then hopefully as time goes on, the people will return and mass will be said.
That's very fascinating because that is a clear indication that there has been some movement in getting ISIS to not be the dominant force in that area. And it's still, as you said, it's not an easy situation, and it's not something that's all clear. And, you know, with all of the car bombs and all of the landmines and stuff like that, there's a lot of danger that's still there. So no one should think that this issue is solved. And even when ISIS is moved out of there, it doesn't solve all the issues. But it's an important issue that, you know, though it's something you can say, hey, we got a little progress and we made some progress there. You know what? Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll speak with our second guest about the worldwide AIDS crisis and epidemic. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. Thank you for being with us on Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Thanks for being with us in this week after Thanksgiving, in the middle of Advent, when we're kind of hopefully and preparing for the coming of Jesus and Christmas. This week, we're talking about some topics that are a little bit discreet from each other, but we spoke with Professor Ada Ferrer about the legacy of Fidel Castro and the situation in Cuba. And I thought one of the things she said, which I think we need to keep in mind, is Cuba didn't begin in the 1950s and 60s with Fidel Castro. There was a whole history of Cuba before that, and there was a history of the relationship of Cuba to the United States. So I think that's something we need to kind of keep in mind. Let's now go to our next guest, who is Catherine Marshall, Senior Fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. Catherine Marshall, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Yes.
Good.
With family, always the best.
Okay. Well, that is great. Let me begin in this way. I mean, I think for a lot of people in the United States, you know, they remember the huge kind of pandemic of HIV and AIDS and people dying in very difficult, suffering ways, whatever it is, maybe 20 years ago or maybe a little longer than that. And then kind of, I think people saying, well, don't we have all these drugs now? And like, can't we treat it? And how do we deal with it now? So I'm delighted that you're with us, because maybe you can help our listeners to kind of understand the progress, the lack of progress, where we are today in the whole issue of AIDS and HIV. So kind of how would you assess where we are today?
We've lived through, I think, an extraordinary journey from the time in 1981 when we first recognized the phenomenon that was HIV and AIDS. And at first, it was completely incurable. It was a death sentence, and a very frightening one, because one of the features of HIV/AIDS is that it can be hidden for up to 10 years. Someone can have it and show no signs. It is particularly a plague in Africa. A large part of the 66% of the people, 35 million people who are living with HIV/AIDS today are in Africa. Only a part of them are on the drugs, about half now, which is miraculous, but it still is only half. Are on the drugs, and there are still well over a million deaths a year, including many children who are born with AIDS and who still die. So one of the figures that people are focusing on this AIDS Day, because tomorrow is the day that is commemorating HIV/AIDS every year, they're focusing a lot on the fact that there are 19 million of the 35 million who are HIV positive don't know it, and therefore can transmit it and have this sentence over them that they're not aware of.
Wow, so that's a huge... How do they kind of estimate that people have it if they don't know they have it? How do they generate those numbers?
Well, there are various methods. Some of it is, of course, sampling. Antenatal women who come to clinics who are tested are a sample of the overall population. So there is a quality of estimate in it, but there's now a long track record, so people are pretty clear on who has the disease, even though they do not know it themselves.
Okay, so worldwide, the estimate is about 36 million people.
Yes.
have HIV/AIDS, and of that, how many are in Africa?
66%.
Okay, so about 24 million.
Particularly concentrated in southern and eastern Africa, where there are some countries where up to 20% of the population is HIV positive.
Wow, that's a huge amount. And so what's the trend line look like in Africa? Is it growing, decreasing, stable? What's going on?
The rate of increase is declining, and that's the victory. That's the remarkable achievement of PEPFAR, the American Support for HIV/AIDS, the Global Fund, which is an international organization based in Geneva, and several other programs have really mobilized really quite extraordinary resources to fight AIDS. And one of the features of AIDS that's fascinating is that it is, I think, the only disease where people who are actually living with the disease have made themselves advocates for all people suffering from it. So there is a large movement. So you have now far more people who are on the ARVs, the treatment, and you have a decline in the numbers of new infections. But I was just looking at the numbers today. The estimate is that there are 5,700 new infections every day.
That's worldwide.
So in other words, it's not over.
That's worldwide, right?
Yes, yes.
That's certainly a large number. We're speaking with Catherine Marshall, who's senior fellow at Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. And we're speaking with her about the worldwide HIV/AIDS disease. And we're doing it because this is the time of the year that we celebrate World AIDS Day. Again, if I go back, you said 1981 and in those times, they usually, I mean, at that point, the two ways that they talked about AIDS being and the virus being transmitted was by sexually and also by drug use of contaminated needles. Is that still how the disease is spread?
Yes, and through contaminated blood.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of hemophiliacs were people who were the among the initial sufferers.
And is that...
And also the other tragic method of transmission is when a woman gives birth.
Okay.
She transmits it to her child unless the appropriate medication is provided, which is actually one of the miracles of progress, that it is relatively easy and the numbers of children who are infected at birth has dropped dramatically, but there still are well over a million children living, 1.8 million children is the estimate of children who have HIV/AIDS.
What's going on in the rest of the world? If Africa is where it seems to be the epicenter, you know, two-thirds of the disease is there, does that mean there's better stuff going on in other parts of the world in terms of containment and not as many new transmissions?
Well, there's some areas of worry. Interestingly, one of them is Washington, D.C. And there are some places where people have become complacent, sort of thinking that it's no longer really, really an issue. People are very worried about Russia and some of the countries in that orbit, where the rates are quite high, but they don't reach the kind of dramatic levels that you see in Africa, where really it becomes a plague on the entire society because so many people are affected, so many children are orphaned, people in the middle of their working lives are struck down. Really, when you start approaching those pandemic levels, it is something that brings the whole society into the picture.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I remember being at a breakfast meeting at the White House in the latter days of President Clinton's administration, and at the table I was sitting at was a religious leader, a black AME bishop who had just been elected to be the bishop in, I think, Southwest Africa. And I remember very clearly President Clinton saying to her, the economy where you're going is really devastated because the incredible number of 18 to 34-year-old males who have been infected with and have died from AIDS means that your workforce has been decimated. And if you don't have that group contributing work the economy, you can't drive the whole economy. And I remember that to this day, and that kind of corresponds to what you've just said about, you know, the workforce being depleted.
I do want to add one other thing, though, that there still is a lingering image of HIV/AIDS as the gay disease, one that affected primarily homosexuals. But in Africa, it is more women than men who are affected.
Really?
For a variety of reasons. One is the terrible problem of the vulnerability of adolescent girls who have often no alternative but to be involved with older men, sugar daddies. So, in fact, it is more women than men.
Wow.
But it's the same, exactly the same effect, because the women are the backbone of the economy, particularly of agriculture. But it is the feminization of the disease is what it's called.
Well, and, you know, interesting what you kind of point out there is that while the word, I forget the word that you use, but you talked about that it is almost surprising or amazing that half the population is on drugs to combat the disease. What are some of the things or programs that have been effective in Africa in reducing the transmission or at least enabling people to kind of live decent lives while they are infected?
Well, when people have the drugs, you have what people describe as a Lazarus effect, that people really can live normal lives, and the regimen of the medication is much less severe than it used to be. It's down to one pill a day. There are programs that focus on education and communication, making the drugs available, making them available at affordable cost, and reducing the stigma that was associated. And this is where I think the religious bodies have had such an important role, sometimes negatively and sometimes very positively, in being willing to be tested. There are many bishops who have gone to be tested to try to show the way. Many of them are speaking very openly about very difficult topics, recognizing things within their own congregations that they had not wanted to or had not been able to address before, like domestic violence. The remarkable work of some of the religious sisters, particularly with children, all of that has helped to change the situation, which was one where initially, some religious leaders refused to bury people who had died of AIDS in the churchyard, and so people denied that they had the disease. So you've seen really a progression. I think it's an inspirational story of hope, because we see how a disease has gone from one that was untreatable, was frightening, threatened to challenge the bases of society, to one that's brought a lot of issues, including gender inequalities, much more to the fore in ways that have encouraged people to act on them.
You know, I'm so glad that you mentioned and brought up to our listeners the fact that that the disease is affecting more women than men, because I think originally, in people who have an older memory, they would say, "Oh, no, it's not a women's disease," because again, the stigma was associated with men and also drug abuse, and you know, there was probably in people's minds they thought male rather than female when those images came to their mind.
Yeah, no, it's a situation that has always been different, particularly in Africa, and to some extent, I think it's true in this country as well. That the sort of male image was never an entirely correct one. But in Africa, the feminization of the disease is dramatic. And it is partly that it is younger women with older men that the girls tend to be more vulnerable to the disease, and they have fewer options to defend themselves.
So is there on the horizon, as far as you see, any new level of treatment or level of prevention that is going to be kind of the next stage in hopefully reducing further the transmission and increasing the lifespan of people with AIDS? Anything new that you see significant on the horizon?
The most dramatic or the most significant initiative, I think, is to try to have more people on the ARVs so that they don't transmit the disease. In other words, the people who have, who are HIV positive but don't know it, are the ones who are transmitting the disease. So if you can get them tested and get them onto the ARVs, they do not transmit the disease when they are taking them correctly. So there are even programs to try to saturate particularly vulnerable populations without even knowing exactly who has it, which would then sort of break this vicious cycle of transmission. I've also been reading, and I'm not an expert on this, but I'm reading that there are some at last positive signs of vaccine development. It's been extraordinarily difficult to develop a vaccine for HIV/AIDS. It's a very complex set of diseases with and they mutate very quickly. But there are some positive reports. So obviously having that would be helpful. Interestingly, one of the initiatives that can make a big difference has turned out to be male circumcision. So there are programs that are circumcising men because that reduces substantially the chances that they will be infected. It doesn't really solve the problem, but it is an important intervention that can have benefits. And then generally raising the level of awareness, though tragically in some situations, if people see a disease that might not kill them for 10 years and they feel that they're in a hopeless situation, for example, they can't get a job or their education is not serving them, many people shrug their shoulders and ignore the advice. So it's very hard to separate the approaches to HIV/AIDS from the broader problem of making sure that societies have jobs, have good education systems, are well governed, that these kinds of issues are talked about openly and honestly.
Catherine Marshall, Senior Fellow, Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, World Affairs. Thanks for taking the time as we are in this time around World AIDS Day for kind of raising the awareness of our listeners that there is still millions and millions upon people who have AIDS. So thanks for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Great. You know, Tom, it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, things go on in the world, and depending on where you live, you're not terribly focused on them. And I think the fact that, as Catherine said, that 2/3 of the incidence of AIDS now or HIV is in Africa, mm-hmm. you know, we can kind of put it out of our mind because there's been such a positive advance, you know, in the United States with disease. But as Catherine pointed out, sometimes people can get a little bit too overconfident and don't do some of the things that, you know, that they forget that there is a danger that is there. So it's so have you begun your Christmas shopping yet, Tom?
I did for the kids, Monsignor. So I have my niece and nephew bought for.
Okay.
Not anybody else.
All right. I do Advent shopping.
Oh.
Because it's Advent time.
That's right. That's right. Yep. That's right. Okay.
Now, you know, my favorite thing to do is what I have, and next weekend I'll do it, not this weekend, but what I do is I have gifts that I buy all year.
Hmm.
So I store them. So I kind of take them out and I look at them and then I say, well, that one goes to this person. This one goes to this, to try to figure out what I have and then what I have to buy. So, you know, but sometimes what I can't remember, some years I'll buy like two of something because I like them.
Uh-huh.
And then I can't remember who I gave the other one to the year before. So I'm afraid that I'm going to give it to the same person again or to the person's cousin or sister. And they're going to say, that's what I got last year. Anyway, but that's so I'm looking forward to. I love this time of year. I think
Me
it's
too.
Great. I think it's wonderful. You know, in New York, they're going to light the tree tonight.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great night to walk and take the subway. Don't
sure,
try to do bus, cab, Uber, or anything else because it's just crazy. We got some rain in New York this year for the tree lighting, which is going to make it a wonderful day to watch it on television.
For sure.
Anyway, thanks so much for being with us. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.